Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Crash Course Fashion Podcast. My name is Brittany Sierra and I'm your host. Today's episode is going to be a little bit different from what we normally do because it's going to be a solo episode. Last week, I think I told you, I attended Circularity 23, which is a conference put on by GreenBiz, and it was absolutely incredible for so many reasons. It's such a different experience to actually attend a conference that you're not hosting. If you've ever heard me talk about the origin story of the Sustainable Fashion Forum, you'll know that I had this idea of bringing people together to learn about sustainability in fashion because I was curious about sustainability in fashion and I was taking the lazy route, or so I thought. At the time, I thought that I could just gather some folks together and that I could learn from them. I had no previous experience putting together an event and didn't realize that actually, if you are hosting an event, you're not sitting there listening, boo-boo. You are producing the event. You're running around. You're making sure that everything is wonderful and great. And now, 7 years later, I'm still doing that. So it's a lot of running around. It's a lot of making sure that everything is going well, that our guests are having an amazing experience, putting out fires, doing all those things, which means that you don't get a chance to listen to the conversations, number one. And also, it's really challenging to have conversations with your community. One of the things I love about SFF is that we are such a global community, and the conference really brings us together from all corners of the globe. But it's often really challenging for me to talk with folks and to have those conversations because I'm often running from here, running from there, running all over the place. And people are stopping me in the middle of me trying to put out some fire. And so it's hard to have a conversation and be present in that conversation without also thinking about all the things that I need to do or all the things that I was just doing and then I got interrupted. So it's really hard. So one of the things for me that I really enjoyed about this conference was that there were so many people that were at the Sustainable Fashion Forum in April at this conference, and that I was able to actually connect with them, actually talk with them, learn more about what they're doing, and connect with them on a deeper level than I have been able to at the conference. The Sustainable Fashion Forum, we are growing our team, which is really, oh my gosh, so exciting. And I will share more about that later. But for now, we're a small but mighty team. And so with the help of our volunteers, we're a larger team, but we're certainly not a massive team. There's a lot of all hands on deck. You know, we're doing all the things. And yeah, that's one thing that I really enjoyed about the conference was being able to connect. I also thought it was really exciting to see so many conversations about fashion this year, and also to see so many people from the fashion industry at the conference. There's a lot of conversations about plastic and recycling plastic and just everything that has to do with plastic, really, and packaging. But it was really cool to see fashion included in the conversation. Also, the conference was massive. I think I saw that there were 1,400 people there, but I don't think that that number is accurate. I think that there were more. There was definitely 1,000,001 people there, like for sure. I have like no doubts in my mind. There were 1,000,001 people at this conference. It was massive. The Sustainable Fashion Forum is about 300-350 people. So it was really interesting to see a much larger scaled up conference and to see how they execute it. So I was absolutely taking notes. I was absolutely like eyeing and looking and seeing how things are done on that scale. I don't know that I ever envisioned the Sustainable Fashion Forum being quite that big, but it was definitely really nice to see how it's organized, see things that maybe other people don't pay attention to. But because I also host a conference, it was very much like, oh, this is a really great idea. We should implement this. We should do that. Oh, I really like that. But at the same time, it also was really nice to see what makes the Sustainable Fashion Forum so special and to see what makes our conference so special. There's definitely differences. And it was also really nice because people who have attended the Sustainable Fashion Forum and were also at the conference were telling me some of the things that they liked and some of the differences and whatnot. So it also really made me feel good about our community and about the conference that we put on, because there are definitely some noticeable differences. And you know, I may be biased, but I just really love our community and I really love what we have built. So that was really incredible for all of the reasons that I just mentioned. But yeah, one thing I will say about the size that I didn't like was that there were so many conversations happening at the same time. I feel like that was really challenging because, you know, there's multiple things that you want to attend, but you can't because you physically cannot be in two places at the same time. And from an organizer perspective, that's amazing because it's like, hey, you want to attend all these conversations? Well, you better send more people, which means more ticket sales. So that's really awesome. But I think as an attendee, it was really challenging because there were multiple things that I wanted to attend but could not. And I did have someone attend with me. However, it made more sense for us to sort of stick it out together so that one can be getting social content and the other could be taking notes, because I had this grand idea that, true to the name of this podcast, I wanted to share with you the crash course lessons that I learned at Circularity 23. So let's dive in. One of the first conversations that I attended was about how technology can enable circularity. One of the things that really stuck with me from this conversation was something that Natasha Frank from Eon said, and that is that waste is just a resource that hasn't been recognized or utilized. First of all, mic drop for that. But she went on to say that for brands, a lot of times at the beginning of a product's life cycle, there are all these sustainability attributes or reasons why the brand markets this product as something that we should buy. Her example was a product that's made out of 100% cashmere. However, what she was saying is that it's not that simple, because once this product gets to the waste management facility, the value of it being made of 100% cashmere is lost. It's gone, because now it's just another sweater, another whatever in this pile of all these other products. And you have no idea that this thing is made with 100% cashmere, or you have no idea that it's made with all of these sustainability attributes. It's all lost, because now it's just another product in the landfill, in an ocean somewhere, piled up with all these other products, and you have no idea what's in it, you have no idea the value, and you have no idea what you can or can't do with it. So what Natasha talked about is the importance of enabling and scaling connected products within the fashion industry, and the importance of enabling the material story within a product itself. So in order to effectively tackle the waste problem, we need to reimagine our approach from the start, and that basically by embedding the material story, the origin, and the composition, and also think like the disposal guidelines into the product itself, we enable the product to be able to communicate. And at that point, this product goes from this anonymous waste to a valuable resource that we have a clear path on how to reuse and recycle it. Another takeaway was from Lindsay Hermes from Avery Dennison, who talked about what is necessary in order to scale the circular economy. There are three things that were mentioned. Number one is data and platforms. That's like one category. The first thing that we need to do in order to scale the circular economy is that we need to have accessible and usable, relevant data. And along with that data, we need robust digital platforms that can host, manage, and share that data effectively. The second thing that we need is physical triggers. So these triggers would interact with the digital tracking system, and they would provide real-time information about the product, about its location, about its status, all throughout the value chain. And the third thing that we need is applications for stakeholders. So to translate the data that's derived from tracking these products into actionable insights, we need user-friendly applications that all stakeholders can access and use, whether you're a, you know, recycler or you're a consumer. We need applications that all stakeholders can use that are designed to ensure data transparency and support informed decision-making. Okay, another thing that I thought was so interesting, which is it technically a crash course lesson? I don't know. But I thought it was really interesting, and I thought it was really eye-opening when we think about sustainability within brands and we think about timelines of why sometimes it takes so long for change to happen. I thought that it was really interesting to have this perspective for those who may not be familiar with the roadblocks that sometimes happen within a single company. Natasha talked about cross-departmental collaboration. And in this context, she was talking about how important it is to being able to successfully implement connected products. But honestly, this could be applied to so many of the sustainability challenges that brands face, basically when they aren't on the same page with each other. So essentially what she was saying is that connected products offer many different advantages to many different departments within a single company. So for example, when it comes to connected products, the marketing team and the marketing department can utilize the e-commerce features, while the sustainability team can also leverage that same data for their sustainability initiatives. And at the same time, the strategy and the business teams and the development teams can also utilize that same data for the things that they're working on. There's a lot of data that comes from connected products that a lot of different departments can benefit from. However, the challenge is budgeting for these products. So unlike a single use, like a single purpose tool, like for marketing, let's say, for example, the benefit of that tool is to the marketing team. So essentially, you just have to get the sign off from the marketing team of, hey, this is how it's going to benefit you. This is the ROI that you'll receive. And then they sign off on it and you can move on. But unlike those types of tools with a connected product, there's shared value between multiple different teams, which means that multiple different teams are often contributing to the cost of that tool and to implementing that tool. And so what you have to do is you have to get all these different departments to understand the tool, to recognize the value, and to agree to contribute their financial resources towards that tool. And so I thought that that was really interesting because when you think of companies, especially from the consumer standpoint, you often think of a Nike, you think of an H&M, you think of a Gap, you think of a Lululemon, you think of all of these different companies as being one singular company. You know, I think that the assumption is that decisions are made and like if it benefits one department or whatever, then you're going to move forward with it, right? Sustainability, we all want it. Let's move forward. But something that I thought was really interesting is that there's all these different departments within a company, and they all have different budgets. They all have different goals. They all have different things that they're working towards. And just because implementing digital tools or like digital passports, that sort of thing, is good for one department, it doesn't necessarily mean that that ROI is going to be transferred over to another department. So from what I'm understanding, the challenge for many sustainability teams is to explain the ROI to all these different departments and to get them to sign off on it, because it doesn't just affect one department, it affects multiple departments. And often, you know, they all have different budgets. And another thing that makes it so difficult is that just because something will result in an ROI for one department does not mean that it's automatically a win and then it's a go, and that it has to be an ROI for multiple departments and multiple people have to see the value, multiple people have to get value in order to move forward with some of this innovative tech. I don't know. I just thought that that was so incredibly interesting, and I think really just underscores the importance of having all hands on deck when it comes to sustainability, and also the importance of not just having like a three-person sustainability team and that's it, but having folks in marketing, having folks in PR, having folks in merchandising, having folks in all these different areas of a company that understand sustainability and that are sustainability focused, even though they, you know, specifically work in marketing, but they also have an understanding of sustainability so that when they're talking about these initiatives, they're not unintentionally greenwashing, or having someone on the finance team that also is a part of the sustainability team. So when you're trying to get stuff pushed through, when you're trying to work with innovative tech, when you're trying to work with these new materials, that you have someone that can have your back as far as pushing this through. I don't know. I don't work for a massive company, but that's just what I think. Another conversation I attended was on the main stage, and it was about Gen Z's role in shaping the circular economy. And first of all, Gen Z just makes me look so bad. Like when I was their age, I don't remember what I was doing, but I definitely was not speaking on panels, and I definitely was not as well spoken, and I definitely did not have such insightful thoughts. So first of all, Gen Z, yeah, Gen Z is getting it. Brian Lewis, who is the program manager at greenbiz.org, was the one leading this discussion. And he asked a question. I can't remember exactly how he asked the question, but essentially the room at Circularity was full with the decision makers, people that work at massive companies, have lots of influence, have lots of power. And his question was essentially, how can those in the audience and those in the room engage with Gen Z and work with Gen Z to have a meaningful outcome? One of the things that was mentioned is that Gen Z is entering into the workplace and that they have a different mindset, that they have different values. And also, I mean, thinking about the fact that they grew up with tech, they're just naturally digital savvy. It was mentioned on the panel that that's their superpower, which was really funny and true. And so one of the things that was talked about was the importance of grooming Gen Z and accelerating their growth so that they're able to move into these leadership positions where they can make a difference. But building on that, I think, let me look at my notes really quick. I believe her name was Sophia Herrera. She said something that I thought was so insightful. And essentially what she was saying is that there are multiple generations at companies, which means that there is an opportunity for thought diversity. And so often we draw this line in the sand between different generations, between young and between old, saying things like, I don't understand them because they're young, or I don't understand them because they're old. But there's this opportunity that if we were able to get past age, then we could collaborate together. I really liked that term thought diversity in the context of age, because I definitely think that it's something that we don't talk about enough. And there definitely is that invisible line in the sand between, you know, them and us, the young and the so-called old. I refuse to call myself old. but you know what I mean? Like, it's a very real thing. And a great perspective that was brought up in the conversation is that Gen Z and younger generations are the ones that are going to have to live with our decisions. And they're the ones that are going to have to live with the systems that we put in place or don't put in place. And so it makes sense to include them in that conversation, to include them as we build out these systems, because they're the ones that are going to have to take it on. And they're the ones that are going to have to deal with the consequences, whether that's good or that's bad. All right. So this is where I completely and totally nerd out. Sorry, not sorry. One of the breakout sessions I attended was about the revolution of fashion's business model. And this was an hour-long conversation, but I really got stuck on the beginning, talking about the evolution of consumerism in the 20th century and just all of the different things that were happening at that time that drove us to where we are now. If you follow me on LinkedIn, you already know that I am obsessed. I mean, like, obsessed with psychology, with consumer behavior, with neurology. I recently got into neurology. I just think that it's so fascinating, our brains, and understanding why we do what we do, understanding why we buy what we buy. I think that it's so much more than simply saying buy less, buy better, because we've been saying buy less, buy better for some time now, and people are still not buying less and they are not buying whatever better is. And I think that in order to really move the needle on sustainability, like, we need to understand what's truly happening, what's truly influencing us, and we need to address it from there. So anyways, I'm obsessed with that. And so this conversation really got me thinking, because the 20th century was brought up, and the rise of thinking of humans as consumers and just everything that was happening at that time, so fascinating. So like I said, the conversation wasn't solely about this. It was really just the beginning, where they were sort of setting the stage and talking about how we got to this place where we are now, where everything is about consumerism and consumption. And so I went home and I researched some of the names that were brought up and some of the things that were talked about. And I learned about Charles Franklin Kettering. So essentially, there was a short depression that happened during 1920 and 1921. And during this time, there was this fear amongst businesses and economists who were basically concerned about the productive capacity of the US economy. And they were worried that basically, you know, that the production of goods exceeded the basic needs of the population and that this was going to trigger this economic downward spiral, that businesses would be forced to reduce their production, which was going to lead to layoffs. And because of that, then consumers were going to spend less, and that this was just all going to result in this like downward economic spiral of doom. So during this time, that's when new marketing strategies and new advertising strategies like really started to take hold that were designed to encourage people to buy more. And this was really when the idea of citizens being consumers really started to take hold, because they were trying to find ways to get people to buy stuff that they didn't need. And so Kettering, he wrote this article in 1929 called "Keep the Customer Dissatisfied," and I'm obsessed. So in the article, basically he discussed consumers and that their dissatisfaction is a driving force for progress and innovation. So backstory, sorry, I should have told you this earlier. So Kettering was an American inventor. He was an engineer. He was a businessman. And he was the head of research for General Motors from 1920 until 1947, excuse me. So when he wrote this article, "Keep the Customer Dissatisfied," it was really from the standpoint of the automobile industry, but truly, I mean, it applied to everything. So he was saying that if businesses were to constantly change or improve their products, right, it would create this sense of dissatisfaction among customers with their current cars, which is what he was focused on, but with their current product or with whatever it is. And so that would prompt them to want to buy new things. Essentially, he was saying that if everybody were satisfied with what they currently had, that there would be no demand for new products, and then that would be bad for the economy. And I don't know. I just think it's so interesting because, first of all, spot on, right? Here we are in 2023. We have our smartphones. We have our electric cars. We have AI doing all of our work for us. We have so many advancements now, right? But it's crazy to think that a mindset that was developed in the 20th century is still plaguing society today. Companies are still utilizing what Kettering wrote in 1929. To keep people hooked and buying things. I mean, think about Apple, right? They come up with a new phone and add another camera or change the button or change how you charge the phone. And suddenly people want a new phone because, God forbid, you can tell that they have an older model than the newer model, right? Like, it's just, it's wild to see how some of these things are still ingrained in society today. And of course, with the fashion industry, I mean, we see how this led to fast fashion, where the goal is to produce high volumes of clothing that mirror the current fashion trends at a low cost, rapid pace, and that this business is just aimed at maximizing profit and encouraging consumers to buy more and buy more and buy more and buy more. So what does Kettering's "Keep the Customer Dissatisfied" have to do with sustainability? When I think about this, I think about the power of perception. I think that's really what Kettering was talking about, is the power of perception. Our behavior as consumers is largely driven by how we perceive products, how we perceive brands, and the act of consumption itself. I think that Kettering's strategy is so much more than just creating new and improved products. It's about influencing how consumers perceive these products in order to drive demand. In the context of sustainability, understanding and harnessing the power of perception really is key. It's not enough to simply offer a sustainable alternative or a sustainable system, right? Like, it's also about shifting consumer perceptions and habits so that they align with this new alternative. So, for example, if consumers perceive the act of recycling or buying secondhand clothing as being a positive and beneficial thing, a trendy thing, a cool thing, then they're more likely to engage with it. And we can see that plain as day with what happened with the secondhand you know, economy, right? And how everyone is shopping secondhand. And yes, there's the, you know, obviously there's the ups and downs, the negatives, the gray areas, the nuances, but you see in mass so many people now shopping secondhand, whereas before there was a stigma around it because now it's seen as the desirable, cool thing to do. And perception really is a powerful driver of consumer behavior. And I personally think that by understanding and influencing consumer perceptions, then we can drive demand for sustainable products, sustainable systems, and all of these things that we go to conferences to try to figure out. None of that works without the consumer, right? None of that works without changing consumer behavior. So for me, that was my takeaway. The conversation, again, was about the revolution of the fashion business model, but I really took away the power of perception. I have to say, I always think it's really interesting whenever I talk about psychology or I talk about changing consumer behavior, there's this prevalent sentiment that shifting consumer behavior is this insurmountable task that we're never going to be able to achieve, and that instead governments and brands should be responsible for fixing the mess that we're in. But I just disagree. First of all, I think that it's really important to understand that just because you focus or think about consumer behavior in this context does not negate or diminish the significance of the role of governments and brands play in this whole narrative. Talking about changing consumer behavior and psychology, it does not shift the blame or shrink the responsibility. It's truly just acknowledging the fact that all stakeholders play a role in the solution. I think of it this way. It was a combination of consumers who are buying a massive ton of things, of brands who produce a massive ton of things, and governments that sat back and let it happen that got us into the situation that we're in now. So I think that it's unwise to think that governments and brands alone are the ones that are going to fix this when the consumer has a massive impact. Yes, I do think that it's going to be a very challenging task to change consumer behavior, to change our mindset, to unlearn so many of the things that we have learned. But you see it all the time with things that are happening in our society today where we have decided that XYZ is something that we no longer want to accept as a part of our society. And so we're actively working to change those things. And I think that this is one of those things. We as people can and have done hard things, and we can continue to do hard things. All right, so another crash course lesson that I want to share with you from Circularity 23 came from a conversation with the founders of the Descendants Project. This conversation was had on the main stage, so you can actually watch this discussion on their YouTube. I'll link it in the show notes because it was such a powerful conversation. And I truly think that everyone needs to watch this discussion. It was so powerful. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. The Descendants Project is a nonprofit committed to the intergenerational healing of the Black descendant community in the Louisiana River Parishes. This region holds intersecting histories of enslavement and settler colonialism and environmental degradation. In this conversation, they discussed Cancer Alley, which is a nickname that was given to this 85-mile stretch of land along the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and Louisiana that contains over 200 petrochemical plants and refineries. It's called this because the residents of this area are predominantly African American and they're predominantly low income, and there is a noticeable abundance of cancer cases within their community because of the proximity to these petrochemical plants and refineries. A thought that I wanted to end this episode with came from Joy Banner, who is one of the founders of the Descendants Project. And she talked about her experience working in business and going to business school and then later teaching and having the experience of working at a plantation, a historical plantation, and noticing the similarities between corporations, the way that we do business now, and plantations. So in the pursuit of profit, plantations relied on exploiting both the environment and enslaved individuals. And these practices were justified in the name of business, with the idea that if we don't extract everything from someone or something, that money is being left on the table. And you can see that there are aspects of our present day business model and the way that we approach business today that mirror that, basically it's like the belief that someone has to bear the burden or even lose in order for maximum gains to persist, in order for maximum profits to be made. And when I say lose, I mean literally lose their life, because depending on where you are in the supply chain, that's how serious it really is today. So in the context of sustainability, it's really important that as we, well, first of all, it's important that we just acknowledge the similarities and patterns, right, of the exploitation of people and planet. But one of the things that was mentioned on stage is that even though the idea of sacrifice being necessary for financial gain has persisted throughout history, it's incredibly important that we reassess this notion in the context of our modern business practices. And as we strive for progress, as we strive for a more equitable society, it's imperative that we challenge the belief that sacrifice and loss are inherent requirements for financial success, like period. And instead, we should strive for business models that prioritize sustainable growth, social responsibility, and the well-being of all stakeholders involved. Also, just wanted to call out that during the conversation, Joe mentioned that recycling is not going to solve this problem, and that taking something made from a toxic substance and turning it into something else does not negate the fact that it is, in fact, a toxic substance. Another thing that she mentioned is that we are bending ourselves in pretzels trying to make plastic work, and that it just doesn't. And that even if you find a so-called solution, the reality is within our current infrastructure, it's just going to someone else's community. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of the Crash Course Fashion Podcast. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to rate, subscribe, write a comment, and also let me know if you liked this solo episode. Never done this before and curious to hear your thoughts. Thanks again for tuning in, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye, y'all.